You listen to 247 Real Talk. This is your host, Julian Perry. Once again, it's a pleasure to be here with you on the 247 Real Talk podcast. On this episode, I'm going to have a mixture of things for you. I have a few notes down here. I'm going to talk a little bit about some things with the Supreme Court that we should really pay attention to. I'm going to talk about what transpired in the last few days with the President Biden's student loan forgiveness program. And I'm going to talk a bit about gun laws, gun control laws in certain states, and mass shootings. So sit back, relax, get whatever beverage it is that you do, and I'll be right back with you. So welcome once again to the 247 Real Talk podcast. It is the night before Thanksgiving on 2022. I look up at my clock there. It's about 20 minutes to 11. Wishing everyone a happy Thanksgiving. Of course, those who listen to this podcast on my audio podcast will hear it the day after Thanksgiving. So it'll be sort of a happy belated Thanksgiving. And those who see this on the Mogul TV network will probably see it in a few weeks, might be even into December. But there's still enough here to reflect on, even if you see this, you know, this episode in December. Looking at my notes, I want to start with, let's start with student loan forgiveness, because that's been in the news all over the place. So I've been speaking about this a little bit, and I took the time to do a bit more research, and I found out that there's probably 6 or 7 lawsuits against President Biden and the student loan forgiveness plan. And I thought that I knew everything that was going on. Obviously, I don't. The more I read, the more I understand a bit more. So there's a couple of perspectives I want to focus in on. One of them is saying that, you know, when you work for government, you become eligible for student loan forgiveness after 10 years. That's 120 payments. And in its current form, it's 120 consecutive payments. So the Biden student loan forgiveness plan does two things. One, it kind of says that, you know, we know that students go through financial ups and downs. There's times when they want to pay off their student loans, so they pay, and then they hit some hardship times, and then they pause. So his plan says that regardless of the pause, the 120 payments, which just works out to 10 years, should not be consecutive necessarily. It should be if you have made those 120 payments, if you've made 120 payments towards your student loan debt. I don't see a whole lot wrong with that. But the part that people have gone to court about is the ability for nonprofits and governments to attract employees. They're saying that a lot of their employees and good employees that they get that come out of, you know, education institutions that have had great achievements in education institutions they're attracted to nonprofits and government employment because of that 120 payment or that 10-year forgiveness on what is usually a 25 or 30-year loan. And the fact that if President Biden gives across-the-board loan forgiveness, then the attractiveness of going to government or going to nonprofits will decrease. Now, I can bore a lot of holes in that nonsense, and I'll say nonsense because of this. Even if you want to discuss that argument, the fact is that President Biden's loan forgiveness is about $10,000 in certain scenarios and $20,000 in certain scenarios. Most of the 45 and 46 million people who have student loan debt have more than that. So while it might, if someone is really making, working for government or not, the criteria, then, you know, you can probably say that it still has no merit to most people, because If I have $200,000 in student loans, then $10,000 or $20,000 forgiveness, depending on my category, still doesn't leave me in a place and all of a sudden I'm free. I still got a mountain of student loan debts. If my intention is to go to public service in order to go through that program, I'm still going to go. There's probably a small cross-section of people who only have $15,000, $20,000, $25,000 in debt, and it would help them to go close to zero. But most of the time, you know, I'm not even sure that people even look at that, you know, the majority of people as their reason to go to government or public service. I think that's a drive of who you want to serve, what you want to do, the dream of what you do, along with coming out of college, fighting the rest of the world for a job, and, you know, being lucky to get a job. And you take it most times where you get it. A lot of times what happens is people go to government service or government employment, and if they're able to sort of rise in the hierarchy, they go and they say, I'll be there for 6 months, and they end up being there for 20 years. That's public service. So there are a lot of things not being considered here, and I think there's a lot of individual perspectives that have gone into these lawsuits. There's another lawsuit that talks about categories of people that were left out. And the one to me that's most hypocritical, that's most vile to me, is the ones where people are saying they have private loans. So these are banks or whatever, and their forgiveness plan doesn't include them. How could it? If you think about it for a moment, if I lend you $20 and you went to the federal government and they lent you $20, and then you were saying, under whatever circumstances, you're trying to get these loans, that these $20 each wiped out. And the federal government came back and said, you know what, don't bother to pay me back the $20. How could they possibly overreach now and say, you know what, don't pay Julian back either, my private money? They can't. So, you know, but people were jumping on the bandwagon because either they want to sabotage it, either they want to see it fail, either they want to, you know, they don't like President Biden. And again, you've heard me on my podcast. I'm not really a fan of any president, past or present, okay? They all have their caveats. They all have their challenges. They all have things that I think that they could have done. And, you know, a lot of times too, even me, you know, we speak from a perspective of what we see. There's a lot of unknowns that we're not privy to because we're not part of inner government and we don't have security clearance, etc. So a lot of things that we see presidents do and we question them and we kind of don't have the whole picture. But I believe in standing firm and standing for something in history. If you get the opportunity to be president of the United States, you know, whether or not you liked or hated some or all or some of President Obama's policies, you have to give him credit for health care insurance. He put everything on the line to get it done. And while there have been so many critics and so many people have gone to court to try to knock it down, they've failed. And they've failed because even though it has its negatives and its caveats, it's actually worked out to help a lot more people get health insurance. And if you ever visit countries around the world where health insurance is simply based on your ability to pay and there's no universal health care, you watch people suffer. You watch people die. You watch people who need three dialysis treatments a week get one because the money they will pay out of their pocket to get the other two because they don't have health insurance is the money they're using to feed their family. And they're only using that money to feed their family, hoping for something to change because they know by only taking one treatment, they're going to die soon. But they've got these people depending on them that they have to do something about. And so they do their best while they can. Look, the whole system is a mess. Even I took the time to go look at, and I'm sorry about the drum set. My board seems to be malfunctioning a bit. I took the time to go look at the income-driven repayment program. And one of the things I saw with that program is that it looks at your adjusted gross income and it asks how much student loans you have. But it doesn't look at the basic, it doesn't take into consideration the basic cost of living. So how can you use it? It doesn't matter where I live, it just matters the fact that I live somewhere that I pay a mortgage or rent, that I can provide statements that show my mortgage, I can provide statements that show my rent, I can provide statements that show my gas bill. Some people use flat billing for gas and electricity, which makes it easier. These are costs that I must incur, that I must pay every month. They are part of my livelihood. So if you're just using adjusted gross income and using some algorithm to come up with what the person can pay, in most cases, they can't pay what it says because you don't know where they live, how they got there, what the circumstances of their life was, and as such, or were, and as such, they have a reason that they're cash strapped. Another thing is, you know, I left out this part, but within the last 2 days, the President Biden's response to the lawsuits was, look, I said that in January 2023, you would have to start repaying loans. And then I saw something that said it was extended to June 30th, 2023. But that's actually, and what I read today is actually not what it is. What it actually says, what the White House has said is, after they go through all these lawsuits, let's say they were able to clear them all by March 2023, then repayment would start 60 days after everything is settled. In the event that it is not settled, the repayment will start, and it goes past June 30th, 2023. Repayments will start regardless, 60 days after June 30th, 2023. So that puts us in what, July, August, so September 2023, regardless. And, you know, I had to think about that for a second because I found that to be incredible. What the president is in fact saying, unless he changes it again, and again, this White House has been very horrible with PR and, you know, and how they've managed what narrative comes out of the White House. I've said that before, even with the loan pauses, the student loan pauses, because they kept saying, this is it, this is the last one, nothing's going to change it. And they kind of can't say that. We've gone through a pandemic. It's 2.5 years going in 3 years into a pandemic. Nothing is the same. We have found out that all that we think we know, we don't. And someone pointed out to me, and I'd already known this, but they kept, you know, reiterating to me, has the government taken the time, student loan or not, to look at what has happened financially to the majority of colored people, of minorities? I want to use that word minorities in a second because even though they're not the minority, or people of color, well, actually, I don't want to do that. Let me retract that. Has the government taken a look at the majority of the population in a certain socioeconomic status that, you know, meets certain criteria in terms of them not being wealthy, in terms of them being poor or lower income or even middle income? And what has happened to their household and their families since? Have they paid attention to the million people that are more that died across the United States? And every few days, we lose a few more people still. Have they paid attention to how many of those households have been devastated financially? And how many of them represent people who have student loans? Have they looked at how many people lost the breadwinner? And now the person who was never a breadwinner has become the breadwinner, but maybe they don't have the education, which they're scared to get because of education loans, and they're working a job trying to make ends meet, right? But they have kids who took out student loans. Or, you know, the person who took the student loans was able to pay them back or intend to pay them back because they have a spouse who was working, and that spouse is now deceased. And they are left to pick up the pieces to pay the bills and take care of their children. So you have a lot of people fall into a lot of different categories. And it doesn't matter. Don't think when you hear someone, oh, this person makes $160,000 a year, that's a big deal. They're billionaires or at least millionaires who are struggling financially. Not because they have money, but because you kind of, you live to the standard of your income. Point being that there are many things that have happened over the last 2.5 years, unprecedented in our lifetimes, that have changed the nature of how we are as people and how we're surviving. I noticed that prices are beginning to go down in certain, like I saw gas start to go down again, but the cost of living is still out the roof and it's not going to go down overnight. And even when it goes down, many people had to go into their savings to take care of their families, whether because they lost a breadwinner, whether because they lost their job, whatever the case may be. And now all those monies that they had allocated to be able to manage to pay their student loans going forward are no longer there. I've heard people who have identified themselves as Republicans, I'm only saying that because they did, you know, point and say you should not have taken the student loans if you didn't intend to pay them. I'm pretty sure that most people who took student loans, that was never their intention. It was always that dream because it's something that's instilled in us in society. Go to school, get an education, you will get a good job. And they go to school and they're told, you know, you got a bachelor's, go for a master's, do as much as you can to educate yourself. And then we're out there dealing with the struggle of the industry. Maybe we're in fighting with so many other applicants. We're dealing with systemic racism. We can't get away from that. So many people of color have so many emails and letters saying, thank you for applying. At this time, we've chosen to go with another candidate. And they're so qualified. And it keeps happening over and over. I'm not talking about one or two times. I know someone has can show proof of well over 200 applications. So the fact of the matter is, this is real. President Biden has acknowledged it is real, but he's not considering it in how to move forward. So to tell people that, you know, if he fails at his lawsuit, you know, it's kind of like what he's saying is, what the language is saying is, I failed at my lawsuit, so I'm sorry, guys. I did my best. You know, you're on your own. Well, we didn't elect a president to be on our own. We didn't elect anybody in Congress to be on our own, Republican or Democrat. I said it before and I say it again. They need to do away with both parties. When the election comes, we need to have two people who, whomever, a bunch of people that we whittle down to two people who give us their opposing ideologies. And the majority of people who vote for one, that person wins, and then they form their party. I think they do that in some countries. Because this whole thing about Republican and Democrat makes people align themselves because of a piece of an ideology. I've met a lot of Republicans who don't agree with two-thirds of what the ideology of the Republican Party is, but that third is enough for them to identify as Republican. I've met Democrats who have done the same thing. They almost hate the Democratic Party, but there's certain things they like about them, very few, and there's certain things they hate about the Republican Party, so they're Democrat, okay? They don't go for the independent parties or the other party, libertarian parties, because those parties don't have enough popularity and never really able to compete at the level of the Republican or Democrats. So here we are faced with a bunch of people in Congress that we keep electing. Some of them we keep re-electing over and over again. Some of them believe that the job is theirs no matter what. They've taken ownership of it because, you know, when you hear someone being or getting accolades for being in Congress 60 years, that sounds like a great achievement. But politically, in terms of how our lives evolve, in terms of how ideology needs to change, is that really a good thing? Has that person evolved over that 60 years enough that they make a difference in the generation that's now? Look at Generation Z. I love Generation Z because every time I see them at protests or wherever, they're intermingled every race, creed, and color. If they hate each other for something, it doesn't have to do with prejudice. I've seen videos where Generation Z kids have torn their parents' ideology apart and basically gotten to a point of contention because they told their parents to their face, you are a racist. I love to see the fact that there's maybe hope, at least in that area, for our children, our children's children, that whatever battle they fight, it won't be because of the color of their skin and the content, you know, and more about the content of your character. So we have work to do in terms of this. We cannot let anyone stop what is right. If you're going to resume student loan payments, then it needs to be done the right way. You need to make sure, and I can't go over this now because I have two other topics and I'm almost out of time, but you need to make sure that people have a fair chance at income-driven, a fair chance of what percentage across the board of what of their income, because I think his plan also says 5% of discretionary funds for undergraduate, but not for graduate. Why would you not do it for graduate? These days, a bachelor's is like a high school diploma. Most people have to go master's and beyond if they want to get to a certain level in life. So, you know, I mean, that should be included too. That leaving that out is something I'd probably argue in court myself as nonsense, President Biden. You need to revisit this. You need to understand the impact on people. You need to understand that sprinkling a bunch of black people in your cabinet and doing a few things to black people doesn't make you, you know, the representative of color people. Because we, you know, our numbers are so few compared to others that you have a long road to go to convince me and many others I speak to about, you know, that you actually understand systemic racism and the journey of color people in the past and even now and what we'll face in the future. I'm going to jump to two other things really quickly. Next one is, you know, we've had a few mass shootings in the last week. I think one's in Colorado, one in somewhere else today in a Walmart. And I keep having this conversation, pro-gun, anti-gun. I keep telling people the two sides need to come together. The politicians need to actually understand what's going on. The anti-gun people need to put down their come off their high horses, because you're not going to get rid of the Second Amendment. And you need to understand that that if you want to make a difference, you need to punish the criminal. You need to make it so horrible for the criminal that people who commit crimes with illegal guns, the price they pay leaves such an example to others that they think twice. But what do you do? And I'm referencing New Jersey. New Jersey had a recent law that I think they're about to pass in their state senate that says people who get, and this is in response to the Supreme Court decision on concealed carry, that people who get concealed carry must now have liability insurance. Well, you have a ton of people who already have premise permits, target permits, hunting permits. And statistics from every federal government agency says that the number of crimes, any crime that's committed by someone who is a lawful gun, law-abiding gun owner, is almost inexistent. It's negligent. But you want the people who have been doing the right thing to get insurance. And you're trying to convince your constituents who are also fed up of the mass shootings that by passing these laws, you're going to make an impact on gun violence in America. So the guy who's doing the right thing, you're going to punish him more. You're going to make it more prohibitive for him to get a carry to protect his family, knowing that he's a level-headed person who's had a gun in his home for years, has gone hunting, has had it on his person back and forth to the range as some laws allow, and has never harmed anyone. Has probably been in confrontations and never reached for his gun because he understands the responsibility of what he carries and he understands the ramifications if he does. And you're, how are you going to, what I call rocking the baby, how are you going to create this myth, this mirage to pull the wool over the people that support you who are really looking for change and gun laws, gun control laws to make a difference and stop mass shootings, is to come up with laws to make it more difficult for law-abiding citizens to do what they're already doing or to do what they would like to do in protection of their families. And somehow you're going to sell that as part of your gun control. What are you going to do now when you pass this and there's the next mass shooting? How many more times are we going to look at you pass laws that have nothing to do with the mass shootings and try to tell your constituents that you're changing laws to make things safer? Maybe you should start telling them that you're simply not capable of doing the job that you were elected to do. The last thing I want to touch on really quickly, and I really am pushing this time limit today, is the Congressional Committee in the House requested access to ex-President Trump's taxes in 2019. We were in 2022. Without any explanation, this week, the Supreme Court granted that access. Now, my father was a judge. He's a retired judge. And it doesn't matter where he was a judge. What matters is, to me, is how he looked at the judiciary, understanding that it was independent and impartial. It seems very suspect to me that you get a request in 2019 and in 2022, that's 3 years later, you finally, without explanation, grant the access to the tax returns 5 weeks before the Republican takes control of the House and will definitely kill any investigation. We'll end it, just like how they're going to end the January 6th committee, they're going to end any further investigation into President Trump. I don't think it's because they believe or don't believe that he's done something right or wrong. I think they're simply going to do it because of that party affiliation, that partisanship that's needed. Our courts must be independent. Our courts must be impartial. We need to find a way to when we elect people to the or we select people for the Supreme Court, that a party, Democrat, Republican affiliation doesn't exist. Unfortunately, that's our system. But if you're going to, without explanation, release that now, you could have done it 4 or 5 months ago, giving them enough time to actually go through this and say, hey, you know what? Ex-President Trump did nothing wrong. Or you know what, American people? He was your president. You have a right to know that this is what he did. And I would hope that within the next 5 weeks that the congressional committee spends day and night, they don't go to sleep if they don't have to get to the bottom of it, to get how many professionals, tax professionals or whatever, to look into this, and then come away with what the truth is. Again, I don't care about Democrat. I don't care about Republican. I don't care about independent. I'm tired of that fighting. I'm tired of these opposing ideologies that are more concerned about power and position than the people and helping the people who have elected them. We hired you. We elected you to make our lives better in masses, in the majority of us. We understand you can't do it for 100% of us, but this should not be where we elect you and then you throw us down on the back burner and the next few years until the next campaign starts, it's all about you and not about us. Any of you in government who have a conscience should really be thinking about this. And if you don't have a conscience, then maybe this is not the job for you. People need help. We need transparency. We need to know that when we go to someone in government, regardless of their affiliation, and we bring an issue from our hearts that really affects our lives, that they're going to look at it in a humane way as a human being and not simply make sure that they follow the party line and ideology, even if it's wrong. As I said to you earlier, tomorrow is Thanksgiving. I have so much to be thankful for. Regardless of all the things I've discussed tonight, I get the opportunity to speak to you in your homes, in your cars, on my audio podcast, wherever you go. I have been blessed enough to share this passion that God gave me, and I've been persistent enough to ask you to join me. It has been a privilege. It's always a privilege to reach out to you, to use this, you know, this time of technology to reach you in so many ways. I continue to expand my reach and I continue to ask you to help me to do so. Whether you pass the podcast name along, whether you share the episode, you share the links, whether you invite someone to be a part of the movement or whether you join it yourselves. The bottom line is we're always going to be busy. Our lives are always going to be busy. But if we don't stand up at some point and carve out some time in our busyness to make a change in our lives and the change in the lives of the future for our children, then not only can't we complain, but if we ever have the ability to look back or look forward and see what happens to our children and the picture is not good, we have only ourselves to blame. I have a few friends on this podcast who are real activists, and I see their efforts. I hear their knowledge. I see their passion and their involvement in every single thing, whether it makes a little difference or a big difference. And I applaud them, for they are part of the movement that we must embark upon. We must continue on to make a change. Again, this Thanksgiving, I have a lot to be thankful for life and for all the things that have happened and all the things to come. I'm hoping that my one little voice, along with all the other little voices, will ultimately join together to be one massive voice that not only calls for change, but ensures that it happens. I thank you so much for the honor and privilege of always being able to speak with you and to share my thoughts, knowing that even if you disagree with me, we can move forward with constructive conversation. I give my perspective. I want to hear yours. I could be wrong. I could be right. Or we can meet somewhere in the middle. But either way, it's always my pleasure. I'm your host, Julian Perry. This has been 247 Real Talk Podcast. Until the next time, do take care of yourselves and each other.